Welcome back to the Anarcho Book Club. So today we're going to cover chapter one of The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell. And I just today got the chapter one text up on the website, so sorry that it took so long, but there was a lot of editing I had to do to get it down to just the text, and that's it. So let's launch into it. In chapter one, let me get my notes pulled up here. So chapter one is the classic story that we all know, I think, from modern myth like Star Wars and other, like Dune. That's another one that I really love. And it really, Dune, now, that movie and book, both of them, the old movie, I'm assuming, or I think they're making a new one, but the movie and the book both kind of capture that, the rise of the hero, or at least from what we're talking about today, the calling of the hero and the refusal of the hero to that call. But Campbell goes through a bunch of older myths, like from King Arthur and the Buddhist myth of the Buddha, and he spells it out and he shows across all time, the span of time and history, and across all nations, including the natives of what is now called the America. All of these myths, they have a similar archetype, as Jung would call it. They all have this similar image of the hero. And in the same way, it kind of speaks to human psychology on how we think of the hero. The hero is called out in, I know in some Norse myths, and also in actually King Arthur's myths, the hero is called into the woods, called out into a dark place, like we talked of last time in the prologue. They're called out away from everyone else. And maybe it's by accident, maybe they venture into the woods. There's a Norse myth in the Poetic Edda where they go hunt. There's a group that goes hunting out into the woods, and they're gone for months away from society. And while they're out in the wooded hills of wherever it is, Norway or Sweden, they encounter the different levels of in chapter one, the different sections. They encounter this call to adventure. Well, the call to adventure is them going out hunting, and then the refusal of the call, it's not so much a refusal of going hunting so much as what they encounter in the woods, and they refuse. They hide back at their cabin, and they hide away from the danger. But then eventually they're visited by these three. So it's a group of three men, and they're visited by these three women. And two of the men go off with the women. One of the men stays, and he's refusing this call. And that is, I guess that is the call. So you hear my hesitation. I had notes on this, and as happened in the past, I have accidentally either deleted them or put them in the wrong folder, and I can't find them now. Because that's just how organized I am. So I'm going from memory here. The one of the hunters, of the three hunters, that refuses this call out with one of the young women, he stays in the cabin, he stays behind, and he eventually transforms there into the hero of the story, and he goes out, and eventually he will fight in a great battle against some great enemy. And this is, and I'm being very vague here, because it's not just this story, but it's also all of these other stories, the Buddha, the story of King Arthur, the stories, and not just King Arthur, but also the stories of the Knights of the Round Table. Each one of them, they go out into, basically, they go into the woods to find something that they're seeking. And how the chapter opens is the same way. The young princess, she looks deep into the well because she seeks desperately her golden ball. And so you can see this throughout all of mythology. Throughout all of history, even, or the telling, at least the telling of history, this going into the woods, going into the darkness. I mean, take World War II, for example, or World War I, either one, but take the World Wars, for example. We all have our mythology around this. The war rages, if you're in the United States, the war rages overseas. In the United States, at least the mythology around the intervention from the United States, The United States refuses the call to action, and they separate themselves from the rest of the world. And then the mythology goes, there's a great intervention, that is the bombing of Pearl Harbor, that drags them into this war. It's that call, it's that first crossing, so to speak. And we can go one of two ways with the third part of this, the supernatural aid, because a lot of people in the United States at the time thought it was the will of God. Because, of course, the preachers and the priests in the United States were preaching the justifications for this war, or most of them. In fact, there were quite a few that weren't, but they were shunned from public view. And so a lot of these preachers and priests, they were claiming that God wants the United States in this war to end the evil of Adolf Hitler and the Japanese emperor, whose name I am forgetting at the moment. But either way, this is a myth-building exercise, because the story of World War II, or at least the U.S. involvement in World War II, is simply a mythology. It's not that it didn't happen, because that's not what myth is. And this is something I may be discussing in every chapter, because I think the perception of myth, the perception of fairy tales, the perception, or at least the wider perception of these things, is skewed. People are led to believe that these are false stories. And I touched on this in the last section that we covered, when we covered the prologue. If you think of a myth as a false story, then you're missing the whole point of the myth. The myth is to teach a lesson. And so we created this mythology around World War II to teach some sort of a lesson to the greater society. And I believe that lesson was that, well, it depends on your perspective, really. From my perspective, and this is purely my perspective and my opinion, based on what I've studied of World War II. From my perspective, World War II was the claim of supremacy by the United States. It was the shedding of the old world, where there were traditional empires, the British Empire, the Russian Empire, all of these different empires. And we were shedding that away and creating a new form of empire, one that is not a singular entity controlling all these other entities through brutal force, through, it was a transition, you see, in my mind, a transition from brutal power, where a singular government entity or a singular entity of some sort claims these lands as their own, and instead it was a more passive power. One could say it was more passive. It was an economic power, where the United States went to war against Germany. And this is not to belittle the war crimes and the crimes against humanity that were committed by the German government and the German military. But it is to say that we traded one evil for another, one that is less visible. And then the two superpowers emerged at the end of this great struggle, this trial, this war. And it was the superpower of the USSR and the superpower of the Allies, or the United States, United Kingdom, and so on. And this emergence of this superpower, of this, according to the mythology, this hero, it lasted for a very long time. And only recently, through the trials of unending or seemingly unending wars in the Middle East, this superpower, known as the United States, is beginning to see cracks in the facade of the hero image. And maybe that's what sold it so well, was all of humanity, we seek a hero, or at least the image of a hero, within our own personal mythologies, within our own personal worldviews. And so for years, for decades, the United States was perceived as the hero, at least by those that were allied with the United States. And by those who are allied with, I'm speaking of the governments, or not of the governments, but of the people under the governments that were allied with the United States. And maybe there was always some sort of resentment because, well, the leader of the United States government, or the United States as an entity, was dominant over the other entities in the world. But they continued this mythology of the hero mythology behind the United States, until recently. Until probably about 20 years ago, from my recollection, the United States was seen as a superpower. Now, the power behind the United States is fading. But let's get back to it, because that's not all there is packed into this chapter. Campbell goes through all of these stories. If you've been reading along with us, you'll see he goes through many different examples to hammer home the point, and to flesh out points as well, but to really hammer home the point that the hero is one of the archetypes of mythology, one of the archetypes of human psychology. And it's almost a need within the human mind to have some sort of a hero figure within your own mythology. And if you think about it, who are your, whenever you're growing up, a lot of young children will have personal heroes. Whenever I was younger, mine was, would have been Michael Jordan, of course, because everyone my age seemed to love this hero of Michael Jordan, the hero myth. And he is one hero that hasn't faded with time, really. He's one of the many that I've had that haven't really faded at all. And as I dug into studying more of the sociological aspects of humanity, I came upon a couple more heroes. And all these heroes are flawed, but in our personal mythologies, the way that they stick there as heroes is that we ignore the flaws and exemplify the strengths. And so another hero of mine was Malcolm X. For years, he's been just the things you read, the speeches you read of his, or the writings you read of his, the foundational ideologies that he held, I think, are very, well, they're very appealing to someone who seeks a more democratic society, a more anarchist society. And I'm not sure, I don't think he was necessarily an anarchist, but many of the principles that Malcolm X used in his own philosophies would jive very well with most anarchists. And so he became a hero for me. He became kind of that shining light, that person that I would always look to for whenever his words. See, and we personify the words, at least I do. We personify it into what he is. And he could be completely different from what I understand. But, and then, of course, at the end of a myth, a hero myth, and I don't think we're there yet, but because we're just on the rise of the story arc of the hero in mythology. But at the end of a hero myth, the hero dies. And the way in which Malcolm X died was not only horrific, but it was in tune with the hero myth. It was, well, it was just, it's similar to other heroes. For instance, King Arthur dies a violent death. And, and as Campbell wrote in this chapter one, he talks about the rise of the hero of the Christ or Jesus in Christian mythology. And he also dies in a kind of a grotesque way. And there's so many others. The heroes of Norse mythology, they all die in grotesque ways. But what joins them all together is the rise of the mythology around them. What joins them together and makes them into what we call heroes today is that, say, the philosophies, the worldviews, the things that they were trying to teach the world through their actions. Or maybe they weren't even trying. It is just their actions that taught. Those things persist. And I think it must have something to do with human psychology, why these things would persist on and on. Why would love your neighbor as thyself persist on? And why would that teaching help to transform just an ordinary person into a hero myth? You see, there's so much about the rise of the hero, and whenever any normal individual finds themselves in a situation where they're rising, because we all will, you see, we all will find ourselves in such a situation where we are rising up to a call. And if you, for instance, let's start with the first section, the call to adventure. We're all called to adventure by the events that are happening around us. And it could be just something locally, for instance. So you live in a community where, let's just say you live in my neighborhood here. This is, let's just take it real down to the micro scale. You live in my neighborhood and you notice, there are potholes all over the road in our neighborhood. Well, here's the call to adventure. I know it sounds silly, but let's just run with it. Because this is, anything can make you act out the hero myth. Any situation can call you to act out this hero myth. And it's the myth, the acting out of the myth makes you, at least according to popular mythology, it will make you a good person. So you're called to adventure. So what is the adventure whenever it's just potholes? And I'm looking out my window right now seeing a pothole. That is a call to adventure. It is a sinking in of the asphalt. And what can we do? Okay, so we have the call to adventure. Now the refusal of the call. This is where many heroes' myths end. Hero myths end. The refusal of the call. I see that pothole and I'm not going to answer that call. I'm just going to sit here and continue recording this podcast. Or I could, so I'll refuse it right now. And according to most hero myths, you can only refuse the call for so long. Even the Buddha refused the call for many, many years. But eventually he found there was an intervention, which is section 3. Supernatural aid. So you refuse the call, you sit here and you look at that pothole and you refuse, you notice it's a problem. It could cause a lot of problems for a lot of people. So you refuse, but you still refuse, even still. And days may go by, months may go by, the pothole gets bigger. And now it's something resembling a crater in the earth. And of course, now this is a public street, so let's be real. The city government or county should come out and fill this pothole. And let's say it's been reported, and you think, that's me answering the call. Now, it's been reported for 2 years, and still, it grows wider and wider. And now, most of the road is taken up by this crater in the earth. People will actively avoid it by driving through the grass. And now the grass is dying. And the refusal of the call, you will find that the things around you begin to grow worn and tired. The grass is dying because people are driving around this pothole. No one is answering the call. And then there is supernatural aid. And I compared this to the calling of the priests and preachers in the United States to join up and fight this war against the great evil. But in this case, supernatural aid may just be, it could be a couple of things, actually. It could be that you're talking to your neighbor and say, yeah, that's a real big problem. I don't know how we're going to fix it. What are we going to do? And there it is. Again, the call. The refreshing of the call to adventure. And you guys get talking and you say, hey, why don't we go around and talk to our other neighbors and maybe we can pool some money and buy the materials to repair this now crater. And let's just say the crater is even sinking deeper now and it's starting to pull some of the grass into it. Yeah, we need to repair this crater. And so that could be the supernatural aid in this hero myth of you and the crater in your neighborhood. Or the supernatural aid could be that you're driving and you try to go around it, but the ground crumbles and your car gets pulled into the crater and now you are out of car. There's another instance where there's supernatural aid. There's a hardship. There's you might even call it a divine intervention if you want to build the myth that way in your own mind. Or maybe your mind will naturally build the myth that way. I know a lot of people who will attribute many of the bad things that happen to them to some sort of a supernatural intervention. People that believe in ghosts will believe that some bad thing is happening because they're haunted. Or, as I was taught growing up, or at least no one ever said it directly, but it was implied that if you do bad things will happen to you because the Heavenly Father does not like whenever you do bad things, so he will allow bad things to happen. Some people believe this, and that'll build into their myth around this crater, a simple crater that started out as a small pothole. Either way, this is a supernatural aid, a supernatural intervention. And so we get to section 4, the crossing of the first threshold. And the first threshold, it can be a lot of things. But this is the beginning of the journey as the adventure goes on. The beginning of the journey. And you go and you say, okay, that's it. I'm going to fix this. So you buy, or you order someone to come in and fill the crater with stone of some sort. So, like Around here, commonly, to fill something like this, you'll fill it with stone first. They call it number two stone. And then you'll cover that over with some sort of asphalt or blacktop or whatever is commonly used. So you order this. They come out and they fill it with this number two stone. Ah, well, here we go. Now the first trial begins, because now you've paid for this, you've had it done, and now you have a police officer pulling up, or a sheriff, perhaps, saying, what are you doing? You can't be doing this. And you refuse. You say, this crater's been here for a year or two now, and the city or county refuses to do anything about it, so we're doing it ourselves. We're going to fix this crater. This is the hero journey, and maybe there are some, just to add to the mythology, there are some of your neighbors standing out there watching you explain things to the sheriff. And the sheriff is the first guardian against your journey. The first beast, as it were, that would block your journey. He tells you to stop, you refuse, and you continue pouring the gravel or the stone into the pit before you. Well, things escalate, and they take you to jail. Because you refuse, and you filled this, and you have modified public property. And this is a myth that we're building now, right? So they've taken you to jail, and now you're in the belly of the whale. And this is where you're stuck. The hero is stuck, and the hero must find a way out. And perhaps the way out is to pay off your bail, go to court, and do it that way. But does that mean you're going to stop, and you're not going to pave over that stone that you've already poured? Because they're not going to dig it out. If they weren't going to fill it to begin with, what makes you think they're going to dig it out and say, no, we got to leave this crater the way it is until we can get funding for it or whatever? Because that happens all the time, trust me. At least around here it does. So now you're out of jail. You've gone to court. You've been fined, say, $4,000 or $5,000, because that's relatively normal for something like this. And at least from what I understand. And now you have to finish your mission. But that is, of course, chapter 2, chapter 3, and so on, where we'll cover that. But I want to focus on this. See, this story is not going to end here. This is just the rise, the story arc, the rise of the mythology around something. And that is an everyday thing that could happen. Now, granted, it may not be an entire crater trying to swallow up your neighborhood, but maybe that's what the story turns into eventually. So say the story is finished. You've paved over it. It's brand new. It looks great. There are no more craters. Years will pass and people will tell the same story over and over again until one day, say a decade later, say people are still telling this story of this, and the people in this neighborhood still live here after all those years. They say, you remember whenever Harag, he came out and he filled that giant crater. And somebody who didn't live there before say, well, a crater? What kind of crater? Why was it so large? And they said, yes, it was a crater. It spanned the whole road. No one could get in or out of the neighborhood. And he paid for for trucks to dump tens of tons or thousands of tons of stone and rock into this crater. And then he paid for it to be paved over. And he saved the whole neighborhood from being locked away. This is how a story will transform. And it's not that it is false. You see, maybe that sounds like a lie. Maybe that sounds like, that's a tall tale. As we say around here, that's a fish story. It's, you know, the kind of story where you say the fish was this big. And every time you tell the story, the fish gets bigger. Maybe it is that sort of thing. And maybe you personally might see that as a lie. But in the end, that is the perception of what was happening by the community. And it becomes a myth. And the myth isn't a lie, because the myth tells a story of what the perceived threat was. It tells the story of how a hero came in and saved the community from this threat. And it all begins with this chapter one, the rise of the hero and the first trials of the hero. And chapter two begins with the road of trial, where now the hero must go through these trials. And maybe it wasn't just the sheriff that arrested him. Maybe there were all kinds of blockades to his adventure. But we'll get into that next week. What I want to focus on now is this rise. It, through the retelling of a myth, sure, it may grow larger than life. And it ought to, for a myth. Because that's telling a story. It's telling the story of how one person or a group of people saved the community from some tragedy, from some hardship. In the story of Beowulf, for instance, the Geats, the men from across the sea, they came across the sea to save a man in his community who were once thought of as great heroes amongst the Scandinavians or amongst the Teutonic peoples of the north. And Beowulf came across the sea with his men in their shining mail armor. Mail is an M-A-I-L. It's a type of armor. And they came to save Hrothgar and his community from the beast that was terrorizing them and had brought them low. And you know, that story, I've long thought... Well, let me just tell sort of part of the story. And they go fight... So Beowulf stays with Hrothgar and his community in the Great Hall. And they eat and drink, and everyone that is of that community is... their eyes are cast down, they are downtrodden, they're exhausted from this great terror that comes every night. And eventually, Beowulf struggles with the beast. He rises up against the beast, tears off its arm, and hangs it from the rafters of the hall. And then he goes after the beast to kill it. And he encounters the beast's mother, and he must kill both the beast and the mother in a great final struggle of that part of the story. And the story goes on, and he must fight a dragon as well, but that's another thing. For this particular story, he must fight the beast and the beast's mother and take them both down. And you know, that story is crazy, right? There's something wrong with that story that a modern mind would say, well, that's just a myth. And yes, they would be right. It is just a myth. But it's also more than that. It's the tale of something that may have happened that has just been blown up out of proportion. It's the tale of mutual aid, as it were, if you can think of it that way. A tale of someone coming from far away. And maybe Beowulf was seeking some sort of riches and glory and so on, and that's okay. But it's a tale of how two communities would come together to fight off some scourge of the land, to fight off something that was holding a community down. And so if you think about it like that, think about what holds you down. And this is how we'll close this episode, because we are getting a bit long, I think. Think about what holds you down in your community. I don't know where you live. Maybe you live in the United States or maybe not. But think about what it is. In my community, one of the main beasts that is holding down the community is, in fact, our local government. It is our mayor who continually steals from the public coffers. And maybe that's the call to action for the hero. But it's also our county council and city council who also, well, they all benefit greatly from the power that they hold. And maybe you might say, okay, that's sort of how it's supposed to be. But if you look at it and you see what is the main thing holding back an entire community, well, the way I see it, a few years ago, well, let's see, it was almost 10 years ago now. It's been so long. I wanted to start a community. And this would be one, I wanted it to be sustainable, not relying on public funding and therefore having to rely on continually updating documents and always scrounging. I wanted to create some sort of a community center for an area in my city that was just so poverty-stricken. In fact, it was the place that I lived. It was the northern part of the city where, I mean, I lived there for years, and the amount of poverty in maybe something, I don't know what you would call it, it's something resembling depravity, because so many people have so little, and they do rely on each other, but in turn, their community is just ravaged by all sorts of external forces. I wanted to create a central point in that community to revive the spirit of that community, but that wasn't the end goal. The end goal was to provide resources for that community to naturally grow. And I found a building. It was a broken building, torn down. It almost needed to be torn down, but it was a historic building, and it would have been really, really beautiful if we could have restored it and made it kind of the center of the community. And yes, of course, we would exclude those that were not part of our community, because it wasn't for the southern people of our city who were rich and so on, or the westerners or the easterners of our city, who were also, they all had their own different communities, their own different central location, where they all kind of communed in a sense. But this community center would be kind of a local, as in just within our northern part of the city, local news. And I wanted to have all kinds of the, like, what would you have? Well, all sorts of things, really. And the way I'd pay for it would be by, I wanted to buy the entire building area, which included, so it was, it's kind of this odd building that's a, it's on the corner of a wide off street. So if you can imagine kind of an odd shaped building, and then it spread way back, and the whole thing was for sale, and it was for sale for, well, it was fairly cheap for what it was. And I was able to get a loan from a bank for this, because I pitched my business plan to them, and we were going to start this whole thing. And on top there would be community, because it was flat roofing, and there'd be gardens, community gardens, and I was going to try to use solar panels to power a lot of it, because I had someone come out and look at it for that, and they said they could probably power about, or provide about 80% of the power from solar, and the rest would be on the grid. And then it had apartments upstairs that I wanted to convert into kind of low-rent apartments, smaller apartments that didn't cost much at all to rent, so that people would have extra money to, well, do what they will, but hopefully try to better their own lives. And all these plans I had, and it all came to a halt. I had gotten all these things done. I had got approved for the loans. I had talked to people like suppliers and local suppliers for resources and kind of bartered deals for different resources. And in the end, my offer on the building was rejected. I was shocked because I actually offered more than they were asking by quite a bit because I wanted to make sure that I got the building. And it was rejected. And I couldn't figure out why. I asked, they wouldn't tell me a reason. I looked around, I talked to people, tried to figure out who beat me on the deal, because I was going to see how much they offered and maybe offer more if it were possible. That was the plan. Well, one day, and back then I smoked cigarettes, sort of. It was, I would buy a pack every now and then. And one day I was in the local, well, the gas station. It was really the only gas station up there. And I was standing in line waiting so I could buy a pack of cigarettes. And there was these two really rich-looking guys in front of me in line. And they were both buying, I don't know what they were buying. They were talking, and they were joking around how they had beaten some kid out of a deal. And that kid didn't even know what was coming because they had paid something like $60,000 for this building, which I had offered over $400,000. And they had gotten it because they knew the owner. And then I recognized, and they were two of the city council members of this city, and they were the representatives of this community, in fact. And I realized who they were, and I realized that one of them was the one who bought the building for almost nothing, and I sat there silently, waiting. I continued to listen to them talk about their plans for the building, and they planned to keep it empty and use it as a storage place for trash, basically. And I was so angry. And I'm still angry with myself now for not calling them out. But looking back, maybe that would have done nothing. But in the end, the whole thing fell through. And that was it. In my mind, according to my own mythology, that was a hero myth that didn't end how most hero myths end. It started out. And as I was bartering deals and getting loans and making plans, that was the story arc. And then it came crashing to a halt. Without a victory in the end, which is how some hero myths go, but they're not popular, because that's not how the human mind thinks the hero myth should go. And in the end, I did end up giving up on that, because by that point, I was out of money, and basically almost on the streets by that point. This was like my last ditch effort to get something going, where I could have a place to live, have enough money to eat, but then also have something that would make a difference in my own community. And it all came to an end. And who was it that made it come to an end? It is those, like the city council members, county council members, and their partnership with the, at least to our locality, the big business entities in our locality, because they're partnering with them to throw their trash in this building. And I brought that. I did one other thing. I did go to the next council meeting, and I raised my concerns about all of this, and they literally laughed at me. Like, the entire council, except for one man, who's no longer on the council, they all laugh. And I was shocked, to the point that I just shut my mouth and walked out. But that is how... But those hero myths They don't last very long in the end. You can tell it again and again, but it's not what the human psyche wants to hear. They want to hear this rise, and they want to hear struggles. They want to hear the struggle of the hero, but in the end, they want the hero to win. Even if it kills the hero, they want the hero to win and to better their community. And that's what it's all about. And that's what whenever I read this first chapter again, and whenever I typed it up again for the website, that's kind of what I drew from it. That's the human mind wants this great struggle. And they want there to be an almost death, and they want there to be, perhaps, some sort of tragedy at the end. And you may not know it, but that'll make the story complete whenever there's a tragedy, but only after the victory. Only after the victory. And that's what I drew from this chapter. This is kind of what I thought of whenever I was reading this chapter. So that wraps up chapter one. If you have any thoughts on this, please feel free to reach out to me. You can reach out to me at anarchobookclub@riseup.net. You can reach out to me on Mastodon at dobbs.town/@Herag, H-E-R-A-G. You can also reach out to me by commenting on my videos on Odyssey.com or LBRY if you have the app. You can comment there or comment on there is a community section on the channel that you can comment in. And if you like any of the audio/video, if you count them as videos, if you like any of them very much, I would really appreciate it if you have an LBRY account or an Odyssey account. I'd really appreciate it if you donated a little bit to the Anarcho Book Club on Odyssey and LBRY. And that's because to publish the videos there, you have to use it's LBCs. And I've said this before, but maybe you're new, you're just listening for the first time. You have to use these tokens that they have. And it's kind of their way of gatekeeping, so you can't just fly by night and publish whatever you want and then leave. And so I like the concept of it. I'm not sure how it works in the end, but I do really enjoy the concept of LBRY and Odyssey. So if you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to stop by Odyssey. If you've already got an account and you have some LBC you'd like to donate, feel free to give me some of that. That'd be great. I'll be putting I did get a Bitcoin account because I have actually had a few people want to donate Bitcoin recently. And, well, a couple. I shouldn't say a few. And I thought, okay. And if you follow me on Mastodon, you'll know it's actually been a while since I created this Bitcoin wallet. But I'll put that up on the website before too long. So, yeah, that is all the front matter for this chapter, and I hope you guys enjoyed it, and I hope you guys have a great weekend. Bye.